Hello, podcast listeners. We know podcasts are a great way to catch up on a program that you may have missed on KSJE, and it's provided as a free service of this radio station. But you know, KSJE is now listener-supported, and so while you enjoy this podcast, we hope that you'll also take some time to join KSJE. Become a member today. It's quite easy to do. Just go to our website at ksje.com/support and pick the level of support that best matches your budget. Thanks again for listening. Here's your podcast. It's supported by San Juan Regional Medical Center, here for you, providing safe, quality care. Stay informed on the COVID-19 developments to protect yourself and your loved ones at sanjuanregional.com or the COVID-19 information line at 505-516-0938 or 888-949-5387. San Juan Regional Medical Center, caring for the Four Corners since 1910. KSJE is supported by San Juan Regional Medical Center, here to meet your urgent and emergent medical needs, whether they are COVID-19 related or not. Medical emergencies happen when you least expect them. Whether it's a stroke, heart attack, illness, or injury, San Juan Regional Medical Center's caregivers are here to provide care to you and your loved ones. Find out more online at sanjuanregional.com. Ten minutes past 8 o'clock. It is Thursday morning, the 7th day of October, 2021. Good morning, everybody. I'm Scott Micklin, and thanks for tuning in to KSJE 90.9 FM, over the air, of course, here in San Juan County, New Mexico, 103.3 FM, over the air in Durango, Colorado, and streaming everywhere else on the planet from our website, KSJE.com, and that includes your smart speaker at home. Welcome also to our viewers who are watching this visual radio program. It is streaming live this morning out to the KSJE Facebook page, our YouTube channel, and our Twitter account. We're glad that you are with us this morning, everybody, because coming up, a great program in store. We'll be talking with my guest, archaeologist Paul Reed, about a great story that hit the news just a few weeks ago about some impressive footprints that were discovered right here in New Mexico down at White Sands. They're really changing some of the information that we thought we knew about the first inhabitation of this part of North America, of course, and there's much more to talk about that. So Paul Reed will explain it all to me and us as we talk this morning here on KSJE. Then later on this morning, we'll be talking with Scott Eckstein. He is returning to politics in the city of Bloomfield. It's part of our coverage of the 2021 election. We've offered free airtime to all of the city council candidates running in contested races, some of whom who have accepted our invitation. That includes Mr. Eckstein, so you'll hear his comments coming up this morning at 8:50 a.m. on KSJE. Next hour, Mick Hess is going to take us roving with the arts, and this morning, Mick is featuring the Symphony for Band by Vincent Persichetti. That's coming up today at 9:06 on Roving with the Arts. Don't forget, you can also connect with us on our Instagram page in addition to Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter. And if you're a podcast person, this program will become a podcast in about a day or two. And all the other programs that we do locally here on KSJE are podcasts. You can subscribe for free wherever you listen to your favorite podcast, places like iTunes and Spotify and iHeartRadio and Pandora. Lots of places to go. Find out all the details on our website at ksje.com/podcasts. Weather forecast, it is partly sunny skies outside our studios here at San Juan College, 50 degrees in Farmington at the moment. We're expecting a partly sunny day today with a high of 74, 47 overnight tonight, maybe a chance of rain showers on Friday, tomorrow with a high of 75 and a low of 54, chance of showers again Saturday and Sunday and cooler with a high only in the mid-60s and overnight lows near 40 degrees. Well, let me introduce my guest who is patiently waiting to talk about this really exciting discovery. Paul Reed is here, of course, with Archaeology Southwest and Salmon Ruins. Paul, good morning. Great to see you.
Good morning, Scott. Glad to be back on with you.
You bet. Thank you for being here. And just how big of a deal is this story? I mean, it was all over the news when it was first announced a couple of weeks ago. And when I first saw it, I thought, I have to talk to Paul about this. And then about seconds later, I got an email from you saying, we have to talk about this. So here we are.
Right. Yeah, no, this is it's potentially game changing for sure. So, you know, we've talked about this a lot, Scott, in archaeology and really in history. You know, we study things and we get new sites, new data that come up, and then we're excited about it because it fits in here, it fits in there. Well, this is, you know, these footprints dated between 21,000 and about 23,000 years ago is just really phenomenally interesting because this pushes back what we thought we knew about how long people had been, you know, in and around not just New Mexico, but all of North America and South America by several thousand years. So, yeah, very exciting.
What we're learning, I guess, then, Paul, is that that there was human habitation then in this part of North America a lot earlier than we thought, is what you're saying, right?
Right, exactly. And, you know, we've talked about different things on the show, sort of, you know, different hypotheses about how different groups of folks from Northeast Asia came over to North America and began to populate North and South America, you know, and over a long stretch of time. So that's an important point that, you know, we should emphasize at the beginning of this, which is that any migration movement, you know, even in the world today and certainly in the past, is not something that we should really conceive of as a singular event. We should think about it as a process with different groups of people, you know, related family groups, lineages, et cetera, doing, you know, making these movements over, you know, for most areas, long periods of time, decades, you know, centuries, even millennia, thousands of years. So the fact that we have found, you know, these very interesting footprints at White Sands basically extends that timeline for migration to, you know, what we call North America today, the New World. So that it's not, you know, so our fixed point in time is, you know, has now moved back by several thousand years. So yeah, very, really interesting.
Right, very much so. And so these footprints are, they appear to be, I guess, teenagers, and you're going to have to explain to me how we know that. And they were left on a sandy area, which is maybe a beach, right? Back in the era when these footprints were left. We all know about the inland sea across much of New Mexico. So I assume this is part of that. Is this what we're talking about?
Well, yeah, but the big sea that you're referencing is actually a lot older. So,
I see.
Yeah, so that's like in Jurassic and Triassic times.
Sorry.
Several hundred years ago, but it's the same idea, Scott, of the climate being very dynamic and the environment changing over these time periods. So in this case, tens of thousands of years ago, you know, we were in the Pleistocene, what we call colloquially the Ice Age, and there was this huge body of water that's been named Lake Otero that sat within this part of New Mexico that we call the Tularosa Basin. So there was, you know, a huge lake, bigger than the Great Salt Lake of today. So a very, very large lake, and it had a shoreline. And yeah, what was found was a series of different prints. So these are the earliest, but when they dug a trench in an area that looked promising, they found multiple layers or strata with footprints that were discernible and that they were able to study. And so, you know, when these were laid down, this was, again, probably a beach, sort of a lakefront beach setting. And yeah, it looks like based on the size of the prints, that's really where we get the teenagers, the teenager idea, and then smaller prints being kids. So the idea was that these were family groups and that the kids were maybe in the care of teenagers while the adults were off doing other things. But yeah, really interesting. And of course, this is the time period when we had all the, you know, the Pleistocene creatures, I guess, if we want to talk about them that way, you know, the mammoths, the mastodons, the giant sloths, you know, large predators like the dire wolf, you know, saber-toothed cats, you know, which are two or three times the largest mammals today. So all that really, all those really dynamic animal life forms were there. And, you know, based on these findings, you know, people, humans were in the mix as well. So particularly interesting.
Right. And we're seeing some of the images from some of the articles. This is on the White Sands website of some of these animals that you're talking about. And so is there evidence, I guess, Paul Reed, of humans or Homo sapiens being around during this time in other parts of the world? There isn't there?
Yeah, in other parts of the world, definitely. I mean, you know, our long stretch of human development goes back several million years. It kind of depends on where we want to say, these are distinct human ancestors, but, you know, at least 2.5 million years ago in Africa. So, so the date here is not, you know, the dates aren't particularly significant worldwide. It's just in terms of what, you know, we think we know, thought we knew about the peopling of the New World, this is pushing us back several thousand years. Of course, you know, we have a very well-dated Clovis period or horizon that is pretty much across North America and down into Central and South America. The earliest dates for Clovis are right around 13,000 years ago. So with these dates, you know, as they've come back at about 21,000 to 23,000, we're pushing this timeline back 8,000 to 10,000 years. And, you know, we have other sites in different parts of North and South America that have come in at 15,000, at 17,000. You know, but this the big sort of the big horizon in North America is Clovis. And so that has, you know, led archaeologists, particularly those who have sort of invested time and career into the notion of Clovis being first, to, you know, really push back and debate, as we've talked on the show. But there is definitely at this point in 2021, even before the footprints, really strong evidence of pre-Clovis by several thousand years in Texas, you know, in Pennsylvania, in places down in Tierra del Fuego, all the way down in far, you know, southern South America. So we've definitely been sort of cracking away, if you will, at the glass ceiling for Clovis. And this really is just more evidence that suggests that Clovis was special, but it's certainly not first. So this is what, you know, the archaeologists are diving into and what we're trying to debate. And what we would really like, you know, with these footprints, of course, is to be able to find other, you know, stratigraphic geologic horizons that date to this period between about 21 and 23,000 years ago, so that we can flesh out our understanding, you know, and see if we can find hunting camps where people gathered wild foods, you know, if we can find the chipstone materials that were used to make tools, because that would really round out our understanding of it. So at this point, the footprints kind of exist in this sort of rarefied zone of, we've got these footprints, you know, the archaeologists, the geologists have dated strata below the footprints, and they've dated strata above them. So we have pretty good stratigraphic control for this set of footprints. There's been some question about when those footprints were laid down, if somehow that surface was laid down, was covered, was, you know, opened up again through erosion, got wet, and if potentially the footprints are more recent and were made into this other surface. You know, so there's some questions. It would be nice to have more dating, more radiocarbon dating, and a lot more investigation at this particular location to see what we can find out. So, but you know, this is how we do science, right? As we've talked.
And yes, this is, right.
This is a finding that will kick off lots and lots of additional research. And, you know, so that's what makes it a great thing.
Right. My guest this morning, archaeologist Paul Reed. He works, of course, with Archaeology Southwest and Selman Ruins. We're talking about the discovery of these, ancient footprints, apparently, at the White Sands National Monument in southern New Mexico. And Paul, maybe take me through a little bit of how these became fossilized, because again, you know, when we walk on the beach today, normally our footprints we were not around long enough to know, but I would assume, you know, that the mastodons or whatever didn't stomp through those footprints and they were somehow preserved and to become fossilized. So can you give us kind of an idea of how those would be preserved in the sand?
Sure. And that's a great question, because as we look at this specific type of phenomenon, footprints surviving for thousands of years. I mean, you know, if we expand the timeline greatly and go into Africa, we have the famous Laetoli footprints in East Africa that are something like 2.3 million years old. And those, in that case, the footprints were actually made in a wet surface, you know, again, on a lakefront there. And they went through a process where they became hardened into stone. These in our backyard here did not go all the way through that lithification or stone making fossilization process, but they were essentially preserved. And this is, who knows what the odds are. This is less than 1%, you know,
right?
Probably 1/10 or 1/10 of 1%. The other thing, and I'll circle back to a second on that, but I wanted to also point out that not just were these human footprints, but, you know, for years and years, the archaeologists working down there have found lots and lots of animal footprints. So that's partly how, you know, they can list specific species of the giant sloths and the mammoths, you know, down there, because those footprints were preserved as well. You know, and as you noted, it's very likely, in fact, you know, almost a certainty that other prints were obliterated by a large animal going through later. So it's this sort of cosmic geologic roll of the dice. So the footprints get laid down, and then there isn't wave action at that point. You know, that's what we think of the water erosion or alluvial erosion. The wind didn't come through at that particular point and blow them away, because that's what happens typically. You know, is either wind or water erosion removes things on the landscape. So these footprints were there. Then they were buried by a, you know, particular strata, a clay-bearing strata that was able to essentially seal those footprints. And then there was not an erosional cycle until additional, you know, either wind-blown or water-laden sediments came in and then sealed them, you know, and then more dirt and strata sediment came in. So it's a pretty rare situation to have those in a very well-preserved setting. And then, you know, these many tens of thousands of years later, to be able to see those on a surface. And in this case, the geologists and the archaeologists working down there for White Sands National Park knew about this. This was a very dynamic setting, this old Pleistocene lake that they knew had already produced lots and lots of other animal prints and tracks. So they knew where to look, and that helped a lot, right, to go in and then dig, you know, careful trenches and sort through those and identify different spots where, yeah, in fact, the footprints were preserved. You know, what would have been great, as I had mentioned, would be to have found, you know, stone artifacts, lithic artifacts of stone tool manufacture in the context with those. So that would really be, I think, for some of the archaeologists who are skeptical about this, sort of the smoking gun, is to have another set of footprints somewhere in this area with, you know, stone tools in context. And then to see what the technology employed for those stone tools, what that looks like, and how that compares to later Clovis and Folsom, et cetera, in North America, and how it looks in comparison to what we see in Northeast Asia, you know, in that 20 to 25,000 year range. So, you know, I'm optimistic that artifacts like that would come up, and then we would be able to really more thoroughly embed our understanding of these footprints, these tracks, within, you know, more of the archaeological record, essentially.
Sure. Understood. And I would assume that this dig isn't done, right? I mean, the next step would be to expand the area to try to find those things that you described, to try to, you know, have links to other discoveries, like tools, like campsites, like things like that may be on the same strata, as you mentioned, that these prints were discovered.
Right, exactly. And if I was doing it, and then I think that's exactly what would be the approach, would be to expand backwards from whatever depth at which the prints had appeared. And again, there were multiple sets in different strata, but, you know, go down to that deepest layer that is dated in this 21,000 to 23,000 year ago range, and then expand horizontally to see what else might be visible down there. And, you know, I suspect that is a research program that they're going to be pursuing. You know, the other interesting thing, of course, is if folks are doing active research down in this area for different reasons, development projects or research, you know, more in an academic setting for the research side, to, you know, seek out strata of this age and to see, because, you know, I mean, most of us working in North America don't map onto, there might be an archaeological horizon here at 20,000 years ago. You know, we're looking more recently. So the truth is that, you know, sometimes you find things inadvertently, and, you know, this was a combination, I think, of an inadvertent find and very specific research where they hoped to reveal something like this. But a lot of times, if you are focused as a scientist on a specific area, you're not going to investigate something that might actually produce interesting results. And, you know, that's the way the world goes, right? We have limited time and money, but that's, you know, as I mentioned at the outset, that's one of the more exciting things about this finding, is that this should spawn lots of additional work at about this 20,000 year horizon to see what is present in New Mexico and what may be present in other places in the West.
Right. Very fascinating. And of course, it just goes to reinforce the fascinating place that we live in. It's right here in our own state. And folks have not been to White Sands. It's a fascinating part of New Mexico and a really interesting part of the world for sure. And this, I guess, discovery, Paul Reed, is also kind of what you've been telling us for years and years and years about how archaeology works and how science works. And, you know, you have your set of beliefs until somebody comes up with something new and challenges it, right? And then that maybe is challenged. As you're talking about this discovery, while being accepted pretty widely, there is some skepticism about it, too, that perhaps these were maybe newer footprints that were laid over this area at some more recent date. And by recent, it's still old, but not as old as we think. Is that's part of the theories that are being discussed?
Right. And that's, you know, when we're working with really early sites like this, what a lot of the researchers will do, knowing that there is going to be skepticism, is, you know, they will keep their projects open maybe longer than they would have. And then they'll invite experts from different areas around the country to come in and to look at the find and to go through this process. You know, it's essentially a vetting process. So,
right.
And it's a little unclear from what's been reported so far in, you know, in social media and in other media, how much of that process has gone on. They have not yet produced sort of a full report. You know, there was somewhat of a report in Science, which was great as a beginning, but there needs to be a lot more sort of stratigraphic information and geologic context for people to go through and evaluate this and kind of see how that falls out. So, you know, and that's not to really in any way demean this finding or immediately cast doubt on it, but, you know, when you're proposing that there were people in this part of North America 8,000 to 10,000 years later, that's a very interesting and very, you know, game-changing claim. So it's something that should be very thoroughly investigated.
Right. And there's also a Native American angle to this as well, isn't there? I mean, a lot of Native Americans that are saying, see, we told you so. We told you we've been here for a very, very long time. Is that what you're hearing too?
Right. And that's absolutely true. So, you know, we have these different realms of knowledge, and I think it's very reasonable and fair to say that archaeologists have overly focused on the things that archaeologists have done well. And that's about training and science and other things. But, you know, I think we've been trying and have done better, I think, in the last few years and decades to bring in other indigenous perspectives and to really broaden what we understand about it. And yeah, we have heard definitely from many groups that, yeah, we've been in this area a lot longer. Our traditions go back further than, you know, your archaeologists or what you're seeing on the ground. And this site is definitely supporting that viewpoint. So, yeah, I think this is the best way that we can do research, is to bring in different perspectives and then, you know, be ready to modify those narratives and expand what it is we think we know. So, you know, and that's, you know, as I mentioned at the outset, though, this does not necessarily cast doubt on the idea that other groups later in time did migrate through an ice-free corridor in Beringia or came down the coast. So, you know, we don't have to look at this as this finding completely replaces, you know, 50, 100, 200 years of research. I think, you know, the way I would want to look at this is another piece in this puzzle that we're trying to put together and build and increase our understanding of how people populated North America and what those groups, how they lived, the stone tools they used, you know, animals they hunted, et cetera. So this is adding to our understanding of that narrative. And, you know, as much as we can bring in indigenous perspectives, that's just all the better for that understanding.
Sure. Well, and I would think it's got to be very exciting and also maybe humbling. I mean, you've been in this line of work for a number of years, and to still have these types of discoveries that kind of shake some of the foundations of what we thought we knew is pretty exciting stuff, is it not? To be able to look at this and say, well, this kind of changes a few of the things that we thought were kind of cut and dried, right?
That's right. And especially when we're looking at things on kind of the edges, I guess, if that makes sense, the edges of, you know, sequences that we think have been well dated. This is when we know there's a whole lot of people in North America, and that time period is Clovis, between about 13,000 and about 11,000 years ago. That's when there was lots and lots of people. They made sites all over almost every one of our 50 states, down into Central America, South America, a whole lot of people. So just a whole lot of those sites. As we push it back in time, the number of sites that have reliable dating before Clovis, before 13,000 or 14,000 years ago, you know, dwindles to, you know, a couple dozen. So, yeah, so that's, it's really on that frontier, if we can talk about it that way, of understanding, you know, those early, early days in North America, that we're going to have findings like this. So, you know, and I think that's a really good point as well to make, that this is changing, this is game changing. And, you know, again, seeing more of the data and understanding how this site fits in. But we're not like taking, you know, the classic baby in the bathwater. So we're not dumping it all out and then we're going to fill up the tub again with brand new fresh water. That really isn't the way that science, I think, ideally works. We want to figure out how to change what we thought we knew and incorporate that into a larger understanding. You know, and to give you an example, Scott, you know, I have to mention Chaco, I suppose, when we talk.
I would be disappointed if you don't.
You know, these areas, these three areas, you know, are some of the most well-dated sites in the world, literally not just in North America, but across the world. So if we found a super early date, for example, out of, you know, maybe going through some collections research at one of the three places, Salmon, Aztec, or Pueblo Bonito, for example, we found a date that was, you know, 2,000 years ago, we wouldn't then say, oh, we were completely wrong about the sequence at, you know, these places, and push everything back by 1,000 years. And in that case, we basically have thousands, if not tens of thousands, of tree ring dates that have built a chronology for these different places. I think the Western Great House at Aztec probably holds the record with something like 4,000 individual pieces of wood that have produced an actual date, you know, for that wood being cut and seasoned and used in the construction. So a couple of dates in that massive set of data are not going to change our understanding of what happened. You know, we would have to think about why there was a much earlier date and you know, explore that as an interesting anomaly. So the contrast then is with, you know, a previously undated unknown horizon. And in this case, I think just two radiocarbon dates, which is a pretty small sample, but those dates came back very, very early. So, you know, that is part of the game changing discussion. So,
right.
Yeah. So I just want to make the point that, you know, it's not that, you know, archaeology or any scientific enterprise is like driving a vehicle down a steep hill that where if you don't make the turn, you careen off, right? And then you're back to square one. It's more of that accrual of knowledge and the building of, you know, hopefully, you know, fundamentally insightful narratives about what happened in these different places that we're interested in the past, and being able to tie those perspectives to what we know from the present as well.
Right. And again, to be clear, these footprints that we're talking about, you know, there really is no carbon dating or anything else like that available, right? This was just rocks and footprints fossilized into rock. There wasn't any organic material stuck to them that would allow you to have a little bit more definitive diagnosis, I guess, of what was found, correct, by as far as dating.
Right. So what was dated was organic material in the strata pretty close above and below the footprints.
I see. Okay.
So it's not an absolute date like a tree ring date would be, or even a date on, say, corn from Pueblo Bonito. If we dated that with radiocarbon method, we would end up with a pretty tight 50 to 100 year range for when that corn lived and grew and then died, because that's when, you know, we can date it once it's passed in. And, you know, you can read the radiocarbon clock, essentially. In this case, right, as you said, these are footprints that were preserved, hardened in a surface. There's no way to absolutely and directly date those footprints. So what we have to rely on is the strata, you know, the relative positioning of those. And then in this case, radiocarbon dates above and below, which say, here's the bracketing for when this geologic strata was laid down. And then from that, to say the inference that during that time period, then the surface was wet, it took the footprints were preserved. So that again comes back to the question about whether there was perhaps an erosional cycle that exposed an older surface that was then capable of taking the footprints and preserving them. So that kind of gets into some of the, you know, the real meat of it and the details of that stratigraphic sequence and whether it's a very consistent sequence through the several thousand years without indications of breaks, erosional breaks, and new, you know, new material coming in.
Sure.
And that's where, you know, and I'm not questioning in any way that the work that was done by the geologists and the archaeologists down there. I'm just saying that's the sort of detailed information in a longer report that's more than just a few pages that will really be necessary to dig into the details and understand it a little better.
Right.
And then hopefully be able to go out and again, seek those 20,000 year old horizons in other places and see, and, you know, again, with these Pleistocene lakes, those are, you know, now dry lake beds, but original Pleistocene lakes, that's a really ideal spot to look for those kinds of sediments and for these types of finds. So I think this may spawn a whole lot more research in New Mexico and elsewhere.
Indeed. Well, I guess that's job security for your colleagues, correct?
Well, it is a continual process to right. try and understand this. And, you know, I think if any of us get too satisfied, it's probably time to, you know, change careers or ride off into the sunset and retire. So,
well, that's,
and, you know, I'm not there yet. So
good. Glad to hear it because we've got more shows to do. So, but this one, I'm afraid we're out of time with Paul Reed, but it's been fascinating as I knew it would be. And I really appreciate you putting this all into perspective for us. So thank you very, very much today.
Yeah. Yeah. You bet, Scott. Thanks for having me on. My pleasure to talk about this and we'll stay tuned to this. And, you know, on the scale of archaeological reports, it'll probably be months to, you know, hopefully just a couple of years to see a report, but that'll be something we can circle back on.
Definitely. Well, it's always great to visit with you and get this put into a bit of perspective and even more exciting when it's right here in our own literally backyard. So thanks so much, Paul.
Great. Thank you.
You bet. That's Paul Reed from Salmon Ruins and Archaeology Southwest, my guest here this morning on KSJE. Did you enjoy that podcast? We hope that you did. And if you did, share it with your friends. And if you really want to keep podcasts like this coming, please support KSJE. You can do it easily online at ksje.com.